This is Near FM
90.3.
Now, I'm delighted to be joined by regular contributor, former academic Alan Tuffrey. Alan, good afternoon and a very happy sunny Monday to you.
Indeed, good afternoon, Donnie. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a super morning, isn't it? Absolutely gorgeous, yeah. A little touch of autumn in the air, but bright and sunny for the time being anyway. Let's enjoy it.
And we will make the most of it while we have it. We are going to talk about something today which is a little bit, I was going to say, a little bit left field, but that wouldn't be us if we didn't. Elitism and what is meant by the term. And I preface what I'm going to say by just repeating what I said at the top of the programme, that sometimes the term may be applied to organisations or people who are not in the slightest bit elitist.
Yes, it's not a term I like, Donnie, because it tends to mean so many different things to different people. Because a lot of people think it's the same as snobbery. So you can take a bad view of people because, sure, they're elite people. They're snobby. They do this, they do that, and that's not our way of doing things. And those people who think they're elite, perhaps, or have different tastes, and it is a question of taste, I think, they might think the people who don't share their tastes are not elite or are plebby or whatever you want to call them. None of these words are particularly nice. And I don't think we should think of it in those terms. We should think of it in terms of people have different tastes of things. People enjoy different things. And they have different routes to get to the enjoyment of them. There's also the idea that I think of an elite from things I've been reading in the last few months. People have particular skills. We don't all share the same skills, which is one of the great things about humanity. We are very diverse. If we were all the same, life would be very tedious. Happily, we are not all the same. And to take a fairly trivial example, I know almost nothing about association football, soccer, as it's usually called. And I care less, quite frankly. It doesn't interest me as a sport. But then I have not invested any serious time in educating myself about it. I've never been motivated to it. You can't do everything. And you, I know, are particularly interested in Gaelic football and hurling. And, you know, those are the sports that you know intimately. So it's a question of how much you've invested in things to do it. I mean, opera is always a good one. Who likes opera? Well, some people like opera. A lot of people say, I don't like opera, but they've never been to an opera. So it's not an easy art form. It's a peculiar, mad art form, actually. It's almost laughable. Now, I've learned to enjoy opera at the level I enjoy it, which is not very sophisticated, over the last, say, 10 or 15 years. And I do enjoy it the odd time. Of course, we can't go to anything now, but we're getting there again. But it took time to learn, and it took time to find a little bit out about it. So I can say, well, yes, I quite enjoy an opera. Now, there are some operas I enjoy and some operas I don't, like most things. You know what they say about modern art? I don't know what it's about, but I know what I like. I'm a bit like that about music.
But would it be looked upon, Alan, that opera, and I suppose maybe I could particularly point it to opera, and certain forms of the art world are looked upon as being elitist, and I'm talking now about people who may while away their hours visiting highbrow art galleries, etc., and maybe those who would go to a library and pick on certain literature to read for the purposes of whiling away some hours, that they are looked upon as elitists, whereas, in fact, they may not be. They're just different from you and me, and everybody is different.
Yeah, I think that's right, Donnie. I mean, things are harder to get into. I mean, there are plenty of things I don't understand. I don't understand much about modern art. And some of it, I think, that's banal. Yeah, that's just nonsense. A child could do that, which actually isn't true, but usually. But, because I am not sufficiently knowledgeable. And I could say the same about lots of other things. But for some, what I don't like is people who say, that's a nonsense. You know, when they haven't gone anywhere near trying it or haven't approached it with any sort of open mind. The kind of elites that I think are more interesting to talk about is there. I think there are two kinds of elite. There's people who have technical or specialist skills, and we need people like that. We need the plumbers and the engineers and the electricians and all those people who can do things that you and I can't do. I want a guy who comes to do things with my plumbing, a guy who knows about plumbing. I don't know anything about plumbing. He does. He may not know anything about things I know things about. That's fine. Everybody to his trade. But I wouldn't regard anything as closed either. Nothing should be in principle closed to the rest of us. The other elite is, and we might spend a bit of time playing around with this, especially with some of the news that's been coming out this weekend, what we might call power elites. Those who rule us, as we might say, they hold power within a particular class. And that we know who we're dealing with, but do we know enough about them? And there tends to be a view of entitlement that goes with that class. And we've seen examples, some trivial, some very serious, in the recent past, where they say, oh, there's one rule for us and another rule for them. I don't need to obey that rule because I'm a different kind of person. I'm an elite person. And we've seen enough of that, and we probably exaggerated a bit. But given the news that with this Pandora Papers that have come out, been all over the news this weekend, we might want to visit that again. So that danger to entitlement, that spread of power into a feeling of entitlement that you may do things that are damaging to society. And if society is damaged, then those who are not part of that elite see what they regard as abuse of power. And then that can breed distrust and may lead to all sorts of antisocial behaviour and possibly revolution and so on.
Would an example of that, sorry, Alan, for interrupting, would an example of that be maybe political dynasties? Now, we see it in Canada, where you have Justin Trudeau, the now president, who is the son of Pierre Trudeau, who was originally president of Canada. You see it here as well, where we have a countless number of Dáil TDs sitting at the moment who are either sons or brothers or related to former TDs or whatever. Yeah. That is that looked upon as elitist, or is that just following in the family trade?
Well, it could be either. I don't think you can say it's immediately elitist. It only becomes elitist if it's somehow exclusive and it's keeping everybody else out. You've got no chance of getting in that constituency because that family has that constituency tied up. Well, that's probably not a healthy thing. I think what worries me more is the sort of big business and those who deal with wealth as opposed to, like the rest of us, deal with salaries and pensions and our wage packets. But people have wealth, that's to say they own the means of production, to use Karl Marx's term, and own big business or land and other things. And big politicians, they are the people I think who have a lot of, and of course the tech giants, as they're called, the people, the Googles and all the others who are out there. So the question we can ask then is, are these people actually different from us? And I think there are some questions, there are in some cases. I'm not entirely sure it's the case in this country, I'm happy to say, but I think it's certainly the case. And I was going to say in the UK, but I think in England rather than the UK. England is, as we're beginning to learn, very different from the rest of the UK. Whereas Westminster is dominated, particularly the Tory party, by people who've had a separate education to anybody else's education. They've been educated in one or two private, very expensive, elitist schools, which require you to have lots of money before you can go there. And they have very separate social lives, and they go to one or two university colleges where getting a degree is one of the least of their preoccupations, but making the right contacts is part of it. And they don't share the lives that the rest of us lead, of wages and pensions and concerns, because they can buy their way around things. Now, that, I think, is...
Yeah, it's a funny thing you said that, and I was actually going to come to that, but you got there ahead of me, as per usual. I was actually looking or listening to something on the English, and stressed English media recently, where they had a list of the last 15, I think, British prime ministers. And the percentage of them who went to, I think it was Eton, was absolutely astounding.
And that could be right.
It was, it was literally seen as their family using that elitist school as a ticket for their prodigies to be prime minister. I mean, it isn't the case that, you know, they went to Eton, got a good education and became prime minister. It was actually the other way around. I want to be prime minister, and in order to be the prime minister, I have to go to Eton. And if I get there and do well, or even just to get there and have that behind me, I'm 75% of the way there to being prime minister at some stage.
Yes, I'm meeting the right people, I'm making the right connections, all of that. And that is an exclusive class. And that's when I...
Sorry, Alan, now, just so that we can put a bit of maybe definition on this, would that be considered elitism?
I think it is, because it's exclusive. It doesn't let the rest of us in, so to speak. And nor is it intended to. That cohort of people see themselves, if I use the word, as having a right or entitled to be the rulers, to put people with their hands on the levers of power who run things at a political level and have the big jobs in industry and state jobs for what we call semi-state companies. And we've seen in the UK people being appointed to all sorts of wonderful jobs recently, some of which they could do and some of which they couldn't, which kind of happens if you appoint on that basis. So that is worrying. I think that is very awkward, to have a ruling caste almost who sees themselves as entitled to rule and nobody else entitled to rule. And I think that's very scary. And I don't think we have that here. There's a bit of that, I think. There are one or two schools one might point to as generating people who perhaps have a disproportionate effect on politics at some level, or say on the judicial system. That'd be interesting to know what the educational and other background of the judiciary is, for example, in this country, and higher civil servants too. But we see a little few signs of entitlement, and nobody has to reach very far in the recent past to see a few cases that have been in the news in the last year or two. I wouldn't be inclined to make too much of them personally, but there are those, whereas a bit of the Ross O'Carroll Kelly stuff, you know, that's, you know, I belong to a particular group. Interestingly enough, thinking of Ross O'Carroll Kelly, and he always used to drive, back in the day, the mother's BMW, I seem to remember. There is a study out there, which I came across recently, that drivers of expensive cars are less likely to stop at a pedestrian crossing. So the more expensive the car, the less likely the driver is to stop at a pedestrian crossing where somebody's waiting to cross. Isn't that an interesting observation? And it came up because somebody was looking at variables in that. They weren't particularly looking to demonstrate that point. They were thinking in terms, this was an American study, they were thinking in terms of race or gender around those things. And they found that, yeah, males are less likely to stop than females, but the bigger the car, the less likely people were to stop. So it's quite extraordinary observation. And if you rummage around, you can find a statement, which I have not been able to authenticate from the original work, that yes, BMW drivers are the worst drivers out there.
Now, it's an interesting point, because I'd like to bring it back from there, really, to the kernel and to why we're having this discussion, just in case people are sitting having their coffee or their tea, wondering why are we talking about this. And I'd like to bring it back to that, because we discussed, you know, the political elitism, the educational elitism, and the, you know, the more expensive cars are less likely to stop at pedestrian crossings, because people who are and do fall into the category of elite are less likely, they're more likely, as you said, to have their hands on the levers of power, but they're also less likely to possess a modicum of empathy for the ordinary, common, decent person.
Yes, I think that, or empathy for anybody. Yes, there's evidence to do that. A fellow I've quoted a few times before in our conversations is Bregman, B-R-E-G-M-A-N, Dutch writer. A very interesting man. But he's written a couple of interesting books. And he says that those people who have power behave worse than those lower down in the hierarchy, if you like, and they show less empathy. And interestingly enough, they can't be shamed. Now, most of us, when we're behaving, if we behave badly, somebody looks at it and sort of expresses disapproval, we'd be ashamed and we might even blush. These people in higher power do not blush, which is a uniquely human characteristic, actually, that we blush. We can be shamed, and that's how we regulate one another's behavior. But these people have somehow moved beyond that. They're not capable of being shamed, which means they can be very hard to dislodge, because they can't say, oh, I shouldn't have done that. I really should resign. We've seen marked resistance to resigning against people who probably should have done in the recent past, here and elsewhere. I think also you combine it with probably a fairly basic human tendency to look after your own, which is grand at the kind of lower levels of, or smaller local levels of society and within families and so on. But when you do it at a sort of national level and you look after your family or others in your caste above all else, and we do see that happening. And we see it particularly, that's most obvious in some of the African countries, and it's happening in India, I'm afraid, too, where there are tribal allegiances which complicate the system. And then if somebody gets into power in one country, they favour their tribe above all other tribes. And that's a recipe for social unrest if ever there was one. So looking after your own, jobs for the boys, if you want to call it that, not to mention the girls. And you also see, as the Pandora Papers is showing us, favourable tax regimes to protect their own wealth and the wealth of those like them. So they can avoid tax. I wrote these notes last week, I might say, long before the Pandora Papers came out on Saturday. I was putting these notes together last Wednesday. People move their money into tax havens. And we saw this stories coming out of the UK about people moving their money, indeed to Ireland, coming up to Brexit and the Brexit doings and all of that, because they wanted to protect their wealth and the tax haven. But the question to ask there is, who is creating these favourable tax havens? And indeed, it is the same people who control the levers of power at the top of government, and have the influence in government, who are creating these loopholes and shell companies and all these other complicated apparatuses for hiding your money. They're the people with the power creating those loopholes. We've seen it in the States, where some of the big industries have been protected from paying huge amounts of tax, which is plenty of argument here about big companies not paying enough tax. It's a circular position. They have the power. They move to protect their own, and they protect their own form of wealth, which is peculiar to their caste.
Yeah, and my guest is former academic Alan Tuffrey, one of the finest exponents you will hear anywhere on any radio station of the English language. And I say that just in reference to something that Alan mentioned there, and I mean, if this isn't a play on words and elitism using the English language to their benefit, It is one of the finest examples of it that I can think of. And it is tax evasion and tax avoidance.
Mm.
One is legal, the other isn't. But basically, they're the same thing. But, you know, it's like another one that I was discussing this morning with a politician where I said, well, you know, people in government don't tell lies, they misspeak.
Yes, there's a book, not a very good one, on this kind of people cheating themselves. The book is called A Mistake Was Made. Not, I made a mistake and I'm sorry. You don't hear that very often. Or, I shouldn't have done that and I'm sorry. That's not the kind of apology that you hear from elite, what we might call, for the purposes of this discussion, elite people. I'm sorry if what I said upset anybody. That's not an apology.
Yeah, that's what we would call in this country, Alan, a backhanded apology. You know, I'm not apologising for offending you. I'm saying it's a pity that you were offended by what I said.
You shouldn't have been offended.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And again, Alan, it comes back, I suppose, to the fact that, and maybe we're all elitist in our own way because we all sort of socialise in our own herd, if you know what I mean. And
yes, I do.
You know, you have these people who, you know, like, for argument's sake, 20 euro would be the same to them as, to an ordinary person, 2,000 euro would be nothing to somebody in the elitist, and they can't understand or appreciate the difference that 20 euro can make to a poor person. Because obviously if they could, a lot of the decisions they're making, they wouldn't be making them.
I mean, I actually heard, I think it was a local politician on UK radio, on the BBC this morning, saying, well, perhaps that might encourage people to go to work and get jobs. Not everybody can go out and get a job, as you know all too well, because it's a sort of topic you deal with day in and day out. Not everybody can get up. If you're a single parent, you can't get up and go to work. You've got to mind a child, or if you've got a sick mother you have to care for, and also, or if you have a serious disability and you can't get about, or you're not well enough to work. That's okay. You can lose 20 quid here and there. And sure, doesn't matter if you don't have any food to eat on Fridays because you're waiting for the pay packet to arrive or the pension to arrive. So, you know, that lack of empathy, that there are people for whom the loss of 20 quid a week is going to be a huge loss. And those people, and I worry, I do think about these people, parents with kids, probably working quite hard in really awful jobs, cleaners and all sorts of rotten jobs that lots of us are glad we don't have to do. 20 quid off there, and then they get a bill from the school for the voluntary contribution, or a 300 quid bill for the school books for the child. And all these things occur at the same time of year. And if you've recovered from that, then it's Christmas now. And you better start spending money again. So it goes on. That pressure is unrelenting. Sometime or another, we're probably going to run out of time shortly. There was a piece in one of the columns I read in the Irish Times on Saturday from an economist whose views I quite like, by the way. I don't normally care for economists very much as they have a strange world. But he actually referred to one of these payments as payments or the checks, which he misspelled, to people who sit and watch Netflix in the afternoon. And I thought, what kind of attitude is that portraying, or betraying perhaps? Because he thinks that people who take welfare payments, there's a dirty word in some circles, are dossers, and they're not working. Whereas the evidence is, again from Dr. Bregman, that people who are given regular payments and a decent level of income actually spend more time being decent people, minding their kids better because they're not worried about where the next cup of tea or the loaf of bread is coming from, and generally having better health outcomes and all the rest of it. Keeping people in poverty so they don't know where their next decent meal is coming from is not a recipe for a better society. Somebody said, and I can never remember who it is, my friend Tom's listening, he'll probably tell me in a few minutes, who said, a society should be judged by the way it looks after the weakest members of that society. And I think that's right. If we've got people who are struggling to put bread on the table and to get shoes on their kids' feet, in the 21st century, in the one of the most developed parts of the world, there's something seriously wrong, I think. So, and there you go.
And indeed, indeed, Alan, it might be a depressing, but it's a very true and pertinent note to finish on, because it is something that we address here on a regular basis, as you and other regular listeners will know. And there seems to be a propensity among the elite, if we can phrase it so, as such, to keep that social divide very much in place. And I do not think it makes for a good society. And I think my friend and collaborator on these pieces, former academic Alan Tuffrey, would agree with me.
I do indeed, Donnie. Yep.
On that note, my friend, we will part company for another fortnight, and I'm already looking forward to our next chat in 2 weeks' time.
Splendid. Take care, Donnie.
God bless you, Alan, and thank you so much.
FM 90.3.